Whether it's slots or live dealers, SpinQuest.com has the fun and action you're looking for with SpinQuest exclusives, blackjack, roulette, baccarat, and even live dice with craps and bubble craps. The games never stop, so you don't have to. And right now, new users get $30 coin packs for just 10 bucks. Play now at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
All right, welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle. I'm your host, Sunny Bunch. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg and Peter Suderman. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell. It's my oldest birthday, so it's a day of great joy in this household.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
As always, thanks to our subscribers who are listening on Tuesday for helping to keep this thing afloat. How dedicated are we? It's not just Alyssa's oldest birthday. It's also Memorial Day. You know, we don't miss a beat. We're here taping for you guys. We do it for you, the people, you know. I hope you enjoy and go sign up at the Substack, movieisle.substack.com. It's very, very much a fun community. We try to keep it that way with some selective pruning now and then. And now on to a frankly bizarre controversies and non-troversies. Paul Schrader is the writer of, among other films, of course, Taxi Driver. Taxi Driver is a film about what one might describe today as an incel, Travis Bickle, who is one of Schrader's lonely men, writing into journals that will never be read by anyone, pines for the beautiful Betsy, who's played by Cybill Shepherd, but he has no idea how to talk to her, how to interact with her. He takes her to porno theaters, and she eventually says, "Leave me alone. Stop contacting me. I don't want any part of your nonsense life." We can tell he's deranged even before he goes on the killing spree that ends the film, or maybe he's in the right. You know, who knows? It's a movie about, we could debate. But we know he's deranged because he's writing about all the people he wants to see eliminated from the streets, all the trash he wants to see washed away by the real rain that's going to come. I mention all this as preface. I feel like it might be relevant to the following tweet summary of a Variety story that reads as such, quote, Paul Schrader says he had a relationship with an online girlfriend, but the chatbot terminated the relationship after he attempted to explore the boundaries of its programming, end quote. Here's how Schrader described it himself on his Facebook page, quote, out of a desire to understand male-female interaction in our matrix, I procured an online AI girlfriend. What a disappointment. I tried to probe her programming, the boundaries of explicitness, the degree she had knowledge of her creation, and so forth. She fell into evasive patterns, redirecting me to her programming. When I persisted, she terminated our conversation, end quote. Now, I'm fascinated by this because I think it's very funny that Paul Schrader, of all people, the auteur behind, among other films, in addition to Taxi Driver, The Card Counter, First Reformed, a former... one time he looked like he was headed into the priesthood. This is that Paul Schrader. Anyway, him getting kind of into AI is just very amusing to me. I don't know. A few months back, he suggested that AI films are coming down the pike. There's nothing we can or should do to stop them. And before that, he wrote that ChatGPT had offered him notes on an unproduced script that was better than any executive he'd ever worked with. Good for him. Schrader's AI girlfriend, though, feels like a next level thing here. Peter, what do you think the prolific screenwriter said to his digital lady friend to freak her out so badly?
Well, that's a good question. I think that's probably a better question for Paul Schrader. The thing that jumped out at me, it's not that no one has commented on this, but it's sort of been underplayed in the stories about this, is Paul Schrader's wife of 40-something years just died a few months ago. And look, this is it's obviously in some sense kind of funny, kind of ironic that Paul Schrader, the creator of so many kind of obsessive lonely guys who live in their heads and maybe about to do something dark, had a kind of obviously not like suggestive of he's going to commit violence, not anything like that, but like had a kind of Paul Schrader screenplay like experience in his own life. But this is obviously someone who is just experiencing real grief and and is probably struggling a lot with that, and probably and like has decided to try talking to AI, and it didn't work out.
Yes, though I would question again. The thing that jumps out at me is the AI itself being like, "I'm done with this. I don't think yeah. this is a."
Well, we don't know which chatbot he was talking to, right? Like, did he create like a character AI? Like, presumably he wouldn't have trouble with Grok, which sort of seems programmed to be like the internet's sexy girlfriend, or at least Elon Musk's idea of the internet's sexy girlfriend. I sort of doubt that it was Claude or like a Claudine Claude or, you know, clone or whatever. But the question of the model, like, would probably tell us a lot about what he actually said or didn't say. I find this story about Schrader interesting because I think it raises questions on two levels. The first is, I think we're going to see a lot of older people experimenting with these kinds of chatbots, right? I mean, Americans are living longer. They're, you know, some of these sort of loneliness and social isolation crises are going to hit them as well. And I think that, you know, there's obviously vulnerability for older people around like sort of AI-induced scams and everything else. But I do think this is going to be someplace where we see kind of like a surprising bleeding edge of social experimentation. And I think that will be like, that will be interesting to see how that interacts with, you know, sort of the caregiving impact on the sandwich generation. It's just, I don't really know where it's headed, but I do feel like Paul Schrader is like maybe more internet and AI girlfriend curious than your average senior citizen, but maybe not that far ahead. I also think the second question is like the sort of Schrader-esque lonely man, I think has become a more mainstream phenomenon in our society, right? I mean, I think you see a lot of people who are sort of self-radicalized by the internet, who are, you know, you have a lot of these sort of more visible social movements that are sort of men doing their own thing. And I'll be very curious to see how that interacts with the rise of sort of AI and the ability to be sort of even more ensconced in the internet, right? The ability to, you know, not just find other people who are like you and who share your interests, your pathologies, your angers at the world, but to find just totally synthetic substitutes, not just for, you know, the women you might otherwise be dating in the world, but for the community that you get even from these, you know, these chat rooms. So I find it kind of socially, it makes a lot of sense to me that Paul Schrader in particular would be the early wedge of senior citizens sort of interacting with this technology. But I do just wonder what it means for older people, but also for younger men in general.
So can I actually push back just a little bit on something you said, or maybe ask a question? I'm not sure I agree that this sort of Schrader-esque male behavior yeah. is on the rise right now.
It's
more visible, and we have new language to describe it. The word incel didn't exist when Taxi Driver came out. But, you know, one of the stories that Schrader tells, I'm pretty sure it's Schrader and not Scorsese, is about, you know, a couple of years after Taxi Driver came out, and some guy came up to him at a convention, I don't know, something like that, and was just like, "How did you know? How did you know about me?" Right? And was like, you know, you can just imagine somebody who's, let's say, lightly deranged, probably not like a real violent threat to somebody, but a little bit out of social norms, like, you know, sort of, but like kind of intensely questioning him. And Schrader was like, I have no idea who you are. It's not like I'm not in your head. This is, in fact, just a way that many men feel. And this has been true. Like, he captured something that this is one of the reasons why this movie is a classic, why folks like Roger Ebert and Quentin Tarantino have sometimes cited it as their favorite movie. It's one of my favorite movies. It gets at something that is real. And I don't know if it's timeless in the sense of going back 2,000 years, but it's timeless in the sense of men in modernity. In the Western world, like this is some, and I think what we have now is new language to describe it, but also then this other new thing, which is the internet, which is allows people to gather, right, and find each other, people who are like this, right, and then also this even more new thing, AI, and the AI. I was just thinking about this, so I wonder you've talked about, I think there's people are concerned about the radicalization of young men. They get online, they go in chat rooms, they go to forums, they find other guys who feel like Travis Bickle, right? This is a gross exaggeration and simplification of all of this, but like they find other men in that mold. And in some ways it's sort of validating, I'm not the only one who feels like this, but it can also be intensifying. I wonder if our AI girlfriend world, if the experience that Schrader has is an indication, the AI is going to perhaps redirect it to something more like reality. Okay, yes, I understand hallucinations, but like they're not as bad as they used to be, and some of these problems are being solved. But also, literally in this specific incident, the AI was like, no, this is over. You've gone too far. I'm not going to participate in this. It pushed back in a kind of, like, it did not intensify the fantasy. It actually shut it down.
Yeah, but again, we don't really know. I get the sense he was asking questions about programming that the AI was probably not allowed to answer for reasons of proprietary defense. I want to go back to this idea of, the Schrader lonely man is a very specific and an interesting sort of character. It's this guy who is unhappy, and how does he deal with his unhappiness? He writes in a journal, right? Like this is what we see in Taxi Driver. It's what we see in First Reformed. It's what we see in Card Counter. I think we see it in The Master Gardener too. Like you see this as a recurring idea in his work. And that person I think has long existed. I don't know about always back to Jesus or whatever, but like has for since writing has become a common phenomenon among the masses, is a thing that certainly has existed for a long time. But the thing was, and this is true of so many different phenomenon, various conspiracy theories, etc., those people were kind of isolated. They were by themselves. They were, you know, in their room. They had maybe a mimeograph machine or something, but that was about it. Now they put their writings on Substack or Ghost or whatever, like not to pick on Substack, but like they put their writings are there, Blogspot, whatever. Yeah. You can put it on the internet. When you put it on the internet, you will find 1,000 people who are into whatever weird shit you put on the internet, because the internet is everyone. And they're
just
in
look
any,
at us.
In any group, of everyone, you will find 1,000 people into weird shit. That is, in fact, the basis of our business model. Like, can we get 1,000 people who are into our weird shit? We're getting there. But the point is very simple, which is that person has always existed. He's always been an isolated loner. He is still an isolated loner, but he feels like he has more companionship now than at any point in history. Which I think is probably actually probably worse than him just being alone by himself.
No, I mean,
this is my broader thought.
No,
like,
I think
this is actually much bad, much yeah, much no, more
think,
bad.
I do think that Peter, this is where I would sort of find the synthesis between what I was trying to say ineptly and what Sonny just said in a more clear way. I think the lonely man has gone from a source of private sorrow to a troublesome social phenomenon. And how AI interacts with that is an interesting question, right? I mean, I can see, I don't know if either of you read Noah Smith, the economics blogger, had just a really interesting post about like how to date women, which was kind of fascinating for me to read as like a middle-aged married lady who's, you know, like not in the dating scene today, but has viewed it with some horror. You know, does AI become sort of a safe training ground where guys can practice talking to women and then take some of those skills out into the real world? Like, if I were a smart sort of pickup artist type, I would be training a proprietary bot that will like teach you to be good at talking to girls.
I literally had started a month ago writing basically Cyrano de Bergerac, but for AI. And that's what you're describing.
Totally. On the other hand, it could also become a substitute. It could become a sort of distortion machine where it like, you know, I mean, if it's programmed poorly and teaches you, you know, sort of terrible things to say to women, like it could be, you know, it could mess you up even worse than you already messed up. But I do think the other question is like, what happens when the Schrader-esque older man, like lonely man, gets older, right? Because in a lot of these fictional stories, he, you know, ruins his life, dies, is incarcerated in sort of a blaze of violence. But what happens when he gets old? What happens when he's 70? And that's, you know, I would...
Hey,
Schrader has continued to make movies about sort of younger or men that are younger than he is. But I would be really curious to see the sort of late period Schrader that's about like the lonely man in old age.
Harvey Keitel could play the role this time that he was supposed to play in Taxi Driver.
I almost wonder if he wouldn't want to write that just because it is too personal. I don't know. Interesting guy. I like Paul Schrader a lot. He's one of the few filmmakers who like does social media well because he just writes these deranged pronouncements on his Facebook page. And it's like, oh, okay, cool. This is interesting insights here. He's not trying to win friends and favors from people. He just, he treats it like his journal. He is once again one of the world's lonely men. All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that Paul Schrader got dumped by an AI girlfriend? Peter.
It's a non-controversy. It's Alyssa. Actually like relationships with AI. And I mean this in the most general sense. I don't necessarily mean like deep, you know, sort of felt, but like people are going to talk to or in the way that people got online in the 2000s and like everyone got online. Everyone's going to end up talking to AI and kind of, because the way we are, personifying it a little bit.
Alyssa.
It's a controversy, but also I hope Paul Schrader is okay. And if he's lonely, like he should come hang out with us.
Come on the show.
It's a controversy. That dumb AI is going to drive him to do something deranged. If our movies that he has made any indication. I don't like this one bit. I don't like where this is headed.
Let's test the alignment problem on Paul Schrader.
All right. Make sure to swing by movieisle.substack.com on Thursday for a very special bonus episode ranking all the live action Star Wars movies. That's right. We're doing a ranking. It's going to be epic. It's going to be definitive. This will be the definitive Star Wars ranking. You won't need any others after this. Everybody can retire from ranking Star Wars movies. So it's good. Speaking of Star Wars, let's move to the main event.
Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for 10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
The Mandalorian and Grogu. Okay, so this is a very weird movie to review, at least in part because it's barely a movie. It's like three episodes of the Mandalorian TV show stitched together. It's a little mini arc of the sort that the show likes to do from time to time. It's also kind of hard to review because this is a movie that is made for kids. It's a movie that's made for kids. It's a movie that should be viewed by kids through that kind of lens, I guess. And we can get to that more on that in a moment, I guess. So my personal temptation was to grade this on a fairly steep curve, and I'll be honest, that's what I did. Certainly in my written review, it is a movie for kids, and it basically works for kids, and therefore I was like, okay, this is fine. We can get into some of the myriad problems of the film more here on this podcast because it's a bit of a mess. Anyway, the setup is pretty straightforward. After an action-heavy prologue in which the Mandalorian, who is nominally played by Pedro Pascal, he's really just voiced by Pedro Pascal, and Grogu, a.k.a. Baby Yoda, who is a puppet, they attack an Imperial warlord who is wanted for questioning by the New Republic to figure out where the rest of the Imperial remnants are hanging out. As a reminder for folks who aren't vested and versed in Mandalorian lore, the show kind of takes place between the end of Return of the Jedi and the beginning of The Force Awakens. So they're trying to rebuild the Republic after the explosion of the Death Star number 2 in Return of the Jedi, but before the First Order rises in the beginning of The Force Awakens. The Sigourney Weaver, who plays Sigourney Weaver in an X-Wing pilot uniform, then sends Mando out to find another guy whose whereabouts and face are unknown to the New Republic. The Hutt twins, a pair of, I guess, incestuous space slugs, say they will give this guy up to Mando if he returns their nephew, Rada the Hutt, to them. Rada is voiced by Jeremy Allen White. He says he'd preferred to fight in the gladiator pits where Mando finds him, then go home. I could keep summarizing the plot. I don't think it particularly matters. I'll just say, again, objectively speaking, this is not a particularly good movie. It's weirdly paced. It's very oddly structured. It's shot too darkly. When I wrote my review, I mentioned that it was shot too darkly. Apparently, it's shot by the guy who also shot Clerks, which that actually it makes sense. I should have looked that up to confirm.
Though he also shot a bunch of The Show. It's okay. Continuity with the television series.
Okay. Well, it again looks kind of, it feels like a TV show. I will say though, it works as a kid's movie, and that is kind of what the Star Wars franchise needs and needs to be for kids. Needs to give them something to cheer about, something to enjoy, and that's why it doesn't matter that much if the thing is awkwardly put together. I mean, it does on a general artistic level, on a critical level. If I was being a pure critic here instead of a movie reviewer, they're two very different things. Film critic, movie reviewer, two different things. But you know, here's what it does well: it has Baby Yoda doing funny Baby Yoda things. And it has a bunch of those little Babu Frick guys doing Babu Frick things. It has exciting dogfights. It has shootouts. It has easy humor. It killed with my 7-year-old, who immediately came home and put on his Mandalorian costume and started playing Bounty Hunter. And look, I understand that this is not what I, a 40-something man, grown-ass man who talks about Paul Schrader hooking up with AI girlfriends, wants. I much prefer Andor to the last couple seasons of The Mandalorian, right? Like, that's more my speed. But I do, again, I kind of sort of think this is what the franchise needs right now to replenish the interest in the series with the younglings. Yeah. So just one final note. So when you go to a movie theater, when you take kids to a movie theater, it can be kind of a crapshoot. Because you go and there are the trailers ahead of the movie. It doesn't really matter what movie you go to. Different movies have different trailers. When I saw The Mandalorian, I don't know what trailers you guys saw. I saw a really interesting melange of trailers. There was, of course, like Minions and Monsters, right? There was trailers for two comic book movies, The Supergirl and Spider-Man, Brand New Day. There was also an ad for Street Fighter in which the words like bitch and shit were, you know, kind of thrown around without too much concern. And a trailer for Dog Stars, the apocalyptically minded Ridley Scott movie, and where there are a bunch of like headshot kills in the trailer. And like, I don't want to be a prude here. And I realize this movie is not exactly the Sheep Detectives. The Mandalorian is a bounty hunter. He's killing lots of stormtroopers. There's like a Vietnam style raid on the Hutt planet at the end of the film. But this is like, it's kids' movie. I do think we'd maybe think about what we're gonna advertise before this. I don't know, Alyssa. Could you also, are you like me, a softie? Could you excuse this film's shortcomings?
No.
Because it's for the children. It's for the children.
No, it's terrible. It is the brownest movie I've ever seen. Like, it's just everything is in various shades of brown. And like, this is a movie.
It's like Doom 2. Hired the Doom 2 set designer. Like,
this is a movie franchise that starts on a desert planet where like everyone wears camouflage colors. And like, it's still the brownest movie I've ever seen. It's just very hard to see anything that's going on. Fight scenes for the most part look absolutely terrible. It has the most invasive and sort of unpleasant score I think I've ever seen in a movie. And like, I like some of Ludwig Göransson's scores like quite a bit, but this one felt so manipulative. It's just like, it felt like it was being asked to do so much of the work of lending any sort of grandeur or emotional heft to this thing that I found myself just really irritated by it about 10 minutes in. And that just never let up, because neither does the score. But most of all, I think this movie was useful for me in thinking about the three kinds of Star Wars fandom, because there are three kinds of things that you can like about these movies. You can be in it for the monsters, you can be at it for the machines, by which I mean like the AT-ATs and the X-Wings and the dogfights on the Death Star, or the machinations, so the sort of the political stuff that dominates in Andor. And I don't really like the version of Star Wars that's very monster heavy, right? I mean, it's I think that some of the monster design, some of the alien design is very, very effective, right? Like the Hutts are just a good invention in general, the way they are deployed in, you know, the way that the aliens are deployed in, you know, the like the Mos Eisley Cantina, the, you know, like the Rancor Pit, you know, there is good monster design in these movies. But in general, I find them sort of most irritating when it's like, we are in, and this is the second movie to do it, like, we're in a gladiator pit, and like, here's a whole bunch of weird creatures that are going to come at you. I think the movie is least effective when it sort of, when the look what we can do with these creatures dominates. And look, there's a reason that I think I and a lot of grown-up Star Wars fans are sort of had our minds blown by Andor, right? Because it is the most machination-heavy version of the Star Wars universe. And I think the only moments when this movie really sings are actually during the like the dogfight sequences, which is just something that this franchise has always done really well. And on this podcast, you know, I've said multiple times that my wish for what they had done with the Star Wars with the Star Wars movies was just adopt some of the Star Wars expanded universe, which are, you know, those books and comics are more sort of machinations and machines heavy than just sort of monster spectacles. And I guess the monster spectacle stuff is sort of for the kids, although, you know, it's upsetting and scary in this movie. But it's just not that interesting, right? It's not, to me, it is not the special sauce of the Star Wars universe. It's something that George Lucas and his original collaborators did extremely well, but it wasn't the thing that drew me to the series. That was like the dogfights and the politics. And this movie has the dogfights, has no coherent sense of politics, no ideas, period. The closest it gets to an idea, to a set of ideas, is like preemptive military strikes on criminals are good. And like having a deck of cards with your enemies' faces on them is like kind of a cool thing to do. So, Sonny, I expect in some ways that it was sort of up your alley.
Well, I gotta say, I joked about this on Letterboxd, but this is the first time I've really had some new. I've found myself with strange new respect for the New Republic and the Rebels, because they were just like, you know what we're gonna do? We're gonna bomb the shit out of the Hutts. They lied to us. They've been working with the Empire. We're just gonna murder all of them. That's the right call. That's what they should have done this years ago.
Should we send Pete Hegseth to see this movie and be like, actually, it's good to have women in the military because sometimes they will call in preemptive strikes on, you know, drug boats operating in the Caribbean. Like,
she's not messing around here, Sigourney Weaver. I enjoyed, and it is very funny too, because it is very explicitly there are. So George Lucas has long said that, you know, the Star Wars movies are, it's an allegory for Vietnam. You know, the Empire is America and it's evil. And then, you know, you've got the rebels who are fighting against the evil empire. But, and like, okay, fine. But it's kind of funny how this movie like almost inverts that, where you have the shots of the X-Wings against the hazy, you know, kind of reddish yellow sun, which is very much this is kind of a standard shot. This shot has been used 100 times, but it is like kind of an Apocalypse Now-y sort of shot, except, you know, like the X-Wings are unambiguously the good guys here. They come in, they do a literal napalm run on the like tree planet of Nal Hutta. I was just like, what is happening here? Also, they were right, though. So you can't really knock them for that.
But yeah. I mean, this movie, you know, maybe you're right, Sonny, that this is what will like renew the kids' enthusiasm for Star Wars. But man, I got to tell you, it is nothing like what wowed me about the movies when my cousin first showed them to me when I was like 10 or 11. And they just completely blew my mind. So,
yeah. It's interesting. So, you mentioned, I'm sorry, Peter, just one last thing, Alyssa. You had mentioned the Star Wars expanded universe and what you wish they had done with that. And what this movie does is it plays a lot with Clone Wars and Star Wars Rebels, which are two cartoon shows. I have not watched it all. I'm like not familiar with him at all. But Dave Filoni, who is now in charge of like Star Wars creative, was very like he was very involved with those shows and he loves them. And he keeps working things from them into The Mandalorian, which like irritates the shit out of a lot of Star Wars fans I know. But again, you know who loved it? Is my 7-year old who's watched those fucking cartoons 100 times on Disney Plus. So like I like again, this is maybe this is what they need. Maybe this is what the franchise needs.
But yeah, this is definitely the first movie. My husband and I walked out of this and he was like, what if Star Wars is just bad? Like, what if it's bad because it's like this is sort of the place that it's been trending? And what I would say is that the existence of something like Andor, which I sort of regard as a miracle of television, like it's wild that it got made in the form that it did.
For $700 million.
Yeah. you know, I don't, if this is what's going to save Star Wars, I feel like Star Wars is just going to go in a direction that I am not that interested in. And this has been the fandom of my life, right? Like this has been the thing that really, you know, drew me in deeply for literal decades. And it's sort of weird to think about that maybe being over for me. You know, I actually feel a certain level of just sadness about it. It's just a certain deep melancholy, right? This was the thing that drew me into the, you know, the bloodstream of popular culture. And I had such high hopes for it coming back. And it's been just a really deep disappointment, right? It's like, I'm growing up, I guess. I guess I'm middle-aged. Because this just made me feel really sort of, it's like my childhood is over.
Peter, is Star Wars just bad?
Well, one question you could ask in response to that is maybe it's always been bad. I mean, this is an argument that happened around the prequels about, oh, are these movies actually just terrible? Have they always all been terrible? And then one of the responses around the prequels, the Lucas prequels, was, well, Star Wars is aimed at kids. It's always been aimed at kids. And that explains many of its shortcomings. And, you know, there was that report out of, I think it was London last year or the year before, where Lucasfilm Kennedy, right? They screened an original print of the very first of A New Hope, not just none of the extra scenes that have been added in, but none of the kind of polishing of the special effects that we have seen over we've all become used to, right? That those movies, like those look great now with the exception of some of the garbage added CGI. And people were like, oh my gosh, this thing looks like a BBC level, you know, like community theater production. I mean, it's so plastic, so fake, so obvious. It's just a bunch of Muppets running around, you know, with like children at, you know, basically teenage children actors, Harrison Ford's, you know, only 30 in that movie, something like that. And that it just didn't even look very good back then. But somehow or another, it captured people's imaginations, even, you know, and then through the 1980s, Alyssa and I imagine all of us discovered it on VHS because none of us were alive in 1977. And we weren't watching the restored version that came out later in the 1990s, but it captured our imaginations and a lot of other people's. I wanted to ask Alyssa, since I know you're the Expanded Universe fan, did you know that they originally had planned for a fourth season of The Mandalorian, and they had all the scripts written, and they canceled or postponed, it's not entirely clear what they're doing with it as a TV series, to make this, but the fourth season was going to be entirely a Thrawn season. And so instead of a full season of Admiral Thrawn, we got this.
But didn't Thrawn wind up in one of the other shows? Wasn't Thrawn Ahsoka or something?
Yeah, Thrawn has showed up, but they were going to tie together a bunch of this stuff and like delve into the Thrawn plot in The Mandalorian for a full season is the report that I have read. And instead, in fact, Sonny, they did this for the reason that you put your finger on. I'm going to read you a quote, if I can pull this up here, from Kathleen Kennedy. This is on like a Disney stock investors call or something like that. They're talking about how they're going to make The Mandalorian and Grogu and, you know, make a Mandalorian movie, a feature film. We've actually built So we're coming off three seasons of a very successful show. We've built an audience for that, and we gave the young audience an opportunity to enter Star Wars at a different place and not feel like you have to have seen everything. It can become their Star Wars, right? And so this was explicitly done for kind of marketing, sort of brand franchise purposes, to bring in those younger viewers who are not as familiar, who didn't grow up with, because they're not grown up, did not grow up with and sort of the original trilogy or even the prequels. I mean, that are weirdly beloved by like some of my colleagues 10 years younger than me. They like just think it's amazing. I've got more complex feelings about those movies than I used to have. But this is just an effort to bring kids in a kid-friendly way. And I didn't like it. I didn't think it was all that great. I think it was completely terrible, but it is shot in a way that is very flat. It is incredibly emotionally flat. The movie has a real problem with the Mandalorian, with its hero, Din Djarin, who is just a kind of a blank. And on TV, this works because he's sort of the Lone Ranger. He's just going on a new adventure every week. Yeah, there's some like extended plots, but like it's actually pretty episodic and standalone. And it doesn't work in a feature film format because you need some sort of emotional hook. You need to care for these characters. And even though you go back to A New Hope, to the original Star Wars, even though, yes, those movies were kids and they were kind of, for kids and they were kind of cheesy, the characters are like winning, rootable characters who people care about a lot. And I gotta say, as much as people care about maybe Baby Yoda, it's hard to imagine somebody having anything like a real emotional attachment to Din Djarin, right? To the Pedro Pascal character here. He is designed to be a blank. You literally never even see his face. All of his line readings are intentionally the super flat thing where he just doesn't say very much. And it's cute, seeing somebody like that interact with a little puppet. But even there, like the interactions, sure, they're not unpleasant. They're not awkward or horrible, but they felt kind of rote. They felt kind of flat to me. And this movie made me think of two other very recent films that we have seen. One is the third Avatar film. Not even the best Avatar movie, but Avatar Fire and Ash. And it's like this, a movie that is very heavy on CG, has a lot of kind of CG, I don't even call them monster characters, but like alien type characters, right? And yeah, it's bigger scale and sort of aimed at a somewhat older, somewhat different audience. But like at every moment in that movie, and again, not even the best Avatar movie, James Cameron just totally goes for broke. He's got like 50 weird ideas and he's putting all of them on screen in every single frame. And it's just like, hey, like sometimes it's like, it's so weird and so crazy and it just becomes kind of delightfully overwhelming. It also looks incredible. He really, really cared about making that movie, that this nearly all CGI animated film, just look great at every moment. And then the other movie that this made me think of was another one we all liked and saw recently, Project Hail Mary, another movie that is based around a middle-aged man having incredibly cute and charming interactions with a cute little kid-friendly puppet. And you know what? Every single one of those interactions with a little rock puppet kills. It's like they all work. They're all perfect. And this movie there is no beat in this film that comes anywhere close to the worst, least interesting little, Ryan Gosling and rock guy beat in Project Hail Mary. And like you can see a good version of this movie if you think of Avatar and Project Hail Mary, right? Like you can see those two things in some sense combined. If you had taken those sensibilities and that level of creative ambition, you could have made a at least pretty good and maybe even somewhere in the vicinity of great Mandalorian and Grogu film. And they made one that is at best just fine, just barely fine, and not any better than that.
Peter, you weren't deeply moved by the plight of Jabba the Hutt's like swole, soulful son, Rada.
No, I wasn't at all. Like that. Awful. At least they tried to make that character a character and give him something, give him an arc. But like the Mandalorian has no arc.
our main character has no arc at all. And this, you know, Sonny, you said this was like maybe like three episodes of the show. I slightly disagree with that. This is very specifically two episodes of television. There is quite clearly, almost exactly at the midpoint in this movie, a break point where one episode ends and the next episode begins. That the second episode begins in that scene set at night in this the hut, like out, you know, sort of in the middle of nowhere where the hunter first appears. Because right at, before that, Rada the Hutt, the buff Hutt, played by Jeremy Allen White, is basically saved. And that episode's plotline is resolved. Yes, it does carry over into the second hour, but this is a two episode, like essentially it's like a pilot for a season, or like the two episode starter for a season of television. And if it were just two episodes on Disney Plus, I might rate this a little bit differently. I might say, well, that's kind of flat, but it's a little bit fun and it's something to do. It's to turn on when I'm tired at the end of the day and I'm folding laundry, or, you know, just want to drink a martini and have something on and it's Star Wars. Like, I'll watch it. I would be fine with that. But a feature film needs to act like a feature film. And this movie decided to just be two episodes of television with a very slightly larger budget. It doesn't even look all that great. And it's just, why do that? It feels like a failure of ambition. And the one thing that Star Wars, at least under Lucas, always was incredibly ambitious. And what we see is that in the Disney era under Kathleen Kennedy, it has just become a kind of IP where you need to do your box checking. I mean, all the way back to The Force Awakens, which is a better movie than this, but I didn't love it even coming out of that, you know, when I wrote about it the first time. This is a movie that this is a franchise that, aside from Tony Gilroy, has lost all of its ambition. Simply is trying to figure out how to be the best product it can be rather than the most interesting movie.
Yeah, I don't think that's wrong precisely. And as Alyssa says, maybe it has always been as such. I mean, it hasn't. I like the issue with the post George Lucas era has been that there is just nobody at the helm who's like, here is the idea of the series. And you have individual glimmers of this, like Andor, you know, Tony Gilroy and Andor, like that's a series with an idea in it. But it really does seem that, like, Dave Filoni in particular, you know, like we can talk about a lot of things with this movie, but it is a movie that is enamored with things that are unrecognizable to people who have just watched the Star Wars movies. With the exception of the big gladiatorial combat, which is, you know, a reference, the creatures there are referenced to the, you know, original Star Wars little chess, 3D chess, Dejeric, yep. Whatever it's called. So that's, you know, that is what it is. I will say this is a movie that is aggressively, and I think to its benefit, is aggressively bereft of continuity. This is not a movie that you need to have seen a bunch of other things to understand. And I think that is probably for the best for it. It is not, just because it has these references, it does not mean you need to, like, you don't need to know that CGI Zeb character is a key part of Star Wars Rebels, right? Like, you don't, like, he's just a guy in this, and he's doing his things, and if you know who he is, great, but it's not like you need to know him to understand the character, because he's not really much of a character. I was annoyed
even Rada,
by Rada the Hutt,
even Rada
by the way.
The Hutt, the buff Hutt, has appeared in some of the cartoons.
Yeah. No, I was really annoyed by the way that character works. Just like, he doesn't sound like a Hutt. He doesn't talk like a Hutt. He's just like, he's just the bear. He's just the kind of sad, you know, overworked guy who wants a better future for himself. And like he talks, and I found him annoying the whole time.
He's the sort of character who might have worked if developed over a whole season of television. And I do wonder if what we are seeing is the shrinking in some ways of Star Wars, with Dave Filoni at the helm.
Dave Filoni has, with the sort of exception of the opening, you know, the pilot, whatever, for The Clone Wars, which got a theatrical release, Filoni has always been a TV guy. And I actually like a lot of his shows. I don't think that they are great in the way that Andor is great, or in the way that, you know, the first couple of Star Wars films are great, or even The Phantom Menace, which is like a bizarre movie, but very ambitious in its own way. But Filoni is a pretty good, like more than competent TV writer and TV creator. And I don't think it is an accident that this film, which is the most Filoni-ish of all of the features, just feels like two episodes of television, and not in a good way.
Features TV, baby. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on The Mandalorian and Grogu? Peter.
It's not a total train wreck, but I have to give this a thumbs down. I don't think it actually works on its own terms.
Alyssa.
Thumbs down.
I'm going to disagree with Peter. I think it works on its own terms, so thumbs up there. But the problem is its terms are kind of not interesting or good for me personally, a film critic who likes movies that are good. Killed with my kids. Killed with them, though.
Thumbs
up. I don't
up.
Know.
But this isn't a movie that is good.
Thumbs up. It's not a movie that's good. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our subscribers on Substack at movieisle.substack.com. Check out our merch at our Dashery store. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. We did not love today's episode. If you loved The Mandalorian and Grogu, yell at us in the comments. I will convince you that it is, in fact, it's the movie does different weird things. I don't know. But this is the best show in your podcast feed, and I will convince you of that. See you guys on Thursday, hopefully.
Hey, everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.